kofta, I mean like, I was recording that. I mean like the skewers of lamb, you know. Yeah. And that you have them like Turkish, Lebanese. I mean. I'm going to sound really racist now, you know, but it's all the same thing out there, you know. It's in the Near East. It's all the same. It's all this. I'm joking. I'm sure it's very different. I'm sure it's very different from region to region. I mean, you tell me. I mean, is Lebanese food very different from Syrian?
No, it's not very different. And Palestinian food is not very different from, I mean, it was all one country originally.
Yeah.
No, there is similarities, but there's also differences. I mean, I'll probably get struck off something if I say that I actually prefer a lot of Lebanese food to Syrian food. I'm waiting for the lightning strike because it's a very personal thing in all these countries.
Yeah.
The one country that really doesn't do it for me for food is Egypt. Again, I'm waiting for the lightning strike. But as a vegetarian particularly, it doesn't do it for me. Lebanon and Syria are very similar, and Palestinian, of course.
Is it because in Egypt vegetarian food is a lettuce leaf and a slice of tomato? I mean, is that what it is?
No, they have something called koshery, which I tried to like but failed. It's like a mashup of pasta and lentils and kind of vegetables, but it's just weird to me.
Anyway, I think the solution's easy. Just start eating meat. I've had so many experts now on my podcast, and I've not chosen them because of this, but you know, they're talking in different things: mitochondrial health, cancer, this, that, everything. And then I talk to them, you know, what health tips and blah blah blah, and the same things keep coming up. Intermittent fasting and heavy meat, animal fat and protein. They go, that's our evolutionary diet. And it's really, really good for you. And it's amazing the number of guests that I've had now who keep saying the same thing. So, but anyway, I respect your vegetarianism. More meat for me. But you're out in Syria, is that right? Am I right?
Yeah, I'm based in Damascus. Yeah, this is actually my fifth year. I came here in 2019, but I was working here from mid-2016 onwards, basically. So on an almost three-monthly basis, I was here for at least 2 weeks to a month.
All right. Well, let's dive in. So I've got a lot of interest in geopolitics, and it was all kicked off by 9/11. Initially, I fell for it. I thought us bad Muslims, because I was a Muslim at the time, we were the cause of it all. And, you know, I joined the TA. I became a Captain Malik to show my patriotism and defense of the country. And I was actually speaking to some of the squaddies after a few months. And they were like, why did you join up? Why are you in the TA now? And I was like, I told them. They all burst out laughing. And I was like, what's so funny? They're like, you know, it wasn't a bunch of Muslims, you know, that did that. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then they were all laughing. They were like, look at building number 7. It was totally stitched up. It's a false flag. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, son, you've been totally duped. It's all bullshit. We're just a mercenary force. And these guys were just calling it all out. And I was just in shock, you know? And I was like, seriously? And they're like, yeah, it's bullshit. It's all bullshit. And like the senior sergeant was like, talking about how he couldn't wait to leave, and he's just counting down the years for his pension, and how the whole thing was just a joke and the morale was crap. And I was like, whoa. That was when I really woke up, something's wrong. And then when I saw that Wesley Clark, you know, clip, I think General Wesley Clark, where he goes, we're going to bomb Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, you know, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, Somalia, like freaking everyone. And I was like, wow. And I think, you know, what happened to Libya was just, that was just horrendous. Awful, wasn't it? And then they started on Syria.
I mean,
it
was one of the most progressive countries in Africa, I suppose, although, you know, they heavily supported, as did Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser, the pan-Arabism movement to control resources, basically, or to prevent their resources being plundered by the West. So in other words, to provide trade within the so-called global South. I hate all this kind of Western terminology because it's so derogatory generally.
Yeah.
You know, and Libya, whatever you think of Gaddafi, I mean, yeah, sometimes he was quite crazy, but actually he also spoke, and honestly, a lot of truth. And he predicted a lot of what was going on, even in his, or what was going to be going on, even in his own country. You know, so extraordinary yeah. what they did there, because it was really, as I said, one of the most progressive countries in the region.
I think we do need to park his flamboyant nature. I mean, the guy, anyone sporting that kind of hairstyle, I mean, it was like a Michael Jackson wet look kind of thing. It was not cool. But anyway, I think there's a lot of misconceptions about him, because even now, recently, a very famous podcaster described him as a dictator, and he wasn't. You know, I think he was a figurehead. As far as I've done some reading about this, he was a figurehead, and he was very much not in control, pulling all the levers. He'd done this thing, the Green Book, and he had, you know, really decentralization. I think this is what he had done, which was have these local communities form, you know, meetings and assemblies, and then they would, you know, nominate a representative and then go up centrally. And that's how decisions were made. And it was very decentralized. And he was literally just a figurehead, a nominal figurehead. And to bring together all these tribal factions and families and create a cohesive state, resist, you know, the colonialism and occupation and get independence, and then create, like you said, a very advanced country in Africa who pushed not just pan-Arabism, but pan-African, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and really supported.
Yeah,
like,
and I would almost guarantee that whoever is saying he was a dictator is a Westerner.
Yeah, they were.
It's a completely different culture. You know, it's ridiculous to talk about bringing democracy to, for example, a country like Libya or Iraq or Syria even, you know, because it's a completely different culture. It's a patriarchal culture. So actually, in a sense, the people need a kind of patriarchy. They need, as they do in the family, you know, everyone can bit at their dad, but if they have a problem, who do they come running to solve the issue for them? It's their dad, right? Mm. And that expands into governance here. And, you know, Western systems, sorry, excuse me, 1 minute. I'm just going to turn this off. Western systems, they're not one size fits all. And that's what's so arrogant about Westerners. You know, they'll throw these terms around like, oh, he was a dictator, he didn't believe in democracy. Syria actually has a pretty good democracy running here, right?
Well, I want you to talk about that in a second. But I'm gonna go back a bit. It's not even just arrogance, it's outright lying and hypocrisy. And what I mean by that is, Vanessa, there ain't no democracy here in the West.
No, exactly. That's what I was also going to say.
It's such a BS. It's a mirage. It's an illusion. It's a delusion. I mean, the idea that we actually have choice, that we have the power to elect people who represent us. Come on. It's a uniparty system. They don't give a damn about us. They don't listen to a thing we say. And they have other masters that they respond to, whether it's corporations, whether it's individuals. I don't know who they are, but they don't listen to us. And all the laws and acts that they bring in, we never voted for them. We didn't ask for them. So this idea that we have democracy.
They bombed Yemen with no parliamentary permission.
Right?
You know, they're completely lawless. And more so in the last 12 years, it's been increasing. Right now, they're vetoing genocide in Gaza. So they're vetoing any kind of peace negotiations whatsoever. And they're voting for war. So,
you know,
if
I was still working in a hospital, you would have just got me suspended again for saying that they're being genocided. Yeah, I mean that's the crazy world that we live in now, that you saying that comment is enough to ruin my career. It already has. You know, Ava Bartlett did that. Yeah, but I love her.
But if you look at the fact that every single country, including South Africa, but every country that's supporting South Africa's case at the ICJ is being labeled literally a proxy of Hamas. That's the ridiculous level to which we've descended. And it's not only from the Zionists, it's from the British government, from the British media, from the American government, from the American media. And it's really becoming, who are the real terrorists? Who carried out 4 assassinations from the beginning of January onwards in Lebanon, in Baghdad, in Syria, in Damascus, right? In Iran, where they targeted mourners going to the burial place of Qasem Soleimani, who, by the way, was also assassinated on a diplomatic trap mission by Trump. So who are the terrorists here? Who's been funding Al-Qaeda and ISIS and every derivative of you know, terrorist groups inside Syria for the last 12 years?
Tell me who.
Same countries that are defending Israel, Britain, US, Turkey, Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Australia, New Zealand, the entire US cartel, the same countries that are now coming to the defense of Israel. Why? Because as Robert Kennedy said, and he said it quite blatantly in a fairly recent talk or question and answer session, he said, you know, Israel is important to us because it's the bulwark between us and the BRICS project, between Iran, Russia, China. It's a military outpost. It's a garrison in the Middle East, and it's responsible for providing intelligence, for providing interference in neighboring countries that are not aligned with the U.S., like Syria. Israel has been effectively arming and funding Al-Qaeda and associated groups in Syria since the beginning, since 2011, 2012, and it continues to do so. You know, so I mean, this is it's the absolute sort of the peak of hypocrisy what they're doing now. Like Yemen suddenly becomes a terrorist outfit, and by the way, it's not the Houthis; it's the entire Ansarullah movement. It's the National Salvation Government, which is a coalition government made up of, I think, it's 38 political parties. So it's not one tribal faction, which they try to reduce it down to, right? It's an entire movement that has been fighting against corruption and imperialism for, well, at least since 2015. So everything they say and do is meant to deceive and misinform and present the enemy as some kind of, you know, either some kind of irrational rebel group, or is a terrorist entity. And everything is backed by Iran. It's like, I mean, it's just completely insane. No agency for these individual resistance organizations and militia. Nothing. For example, the PMU in Iraq, they're not even entirely Islamist. They're completely secular in their makeup. So they're inclusive of Iraqi Christians, Iraqi Yazidi, Iraqi Sunni, right? It's not only Shia Islam. The same in Yemen. The Zaydi in Iran are actually kind of follow a completely different line to the Iranian Shia. And they're actually much closer to the Shafi, the Sunni Muslims in Yemen. And there was not any sectarian division before 2015. And actually, before the Saudi proxy aggression, of course, it was working on behalf of the US and Israel and the UK. Yemen was a former, or Aden in the south was a former British colony. And we see how the British treated the Yemenis until, you know, they were forced out. And I think it was 1936. I could be wrong on that. Shafi and Zaydi lived peacefully side by side. But what did the Saudi-backed government want to do? He wanted to partition it into seven statelets. Of course, the Balkanization project is something that we've seen everywhere, from Yugoslavia through to Iraq, through to Libya to some extent, and they're desperate to make it happen in Syria. Basically, Jamal Ben Omar, who was the UN envoy to Yemen at the time, he said, there's no need for this aggression. The Yemenis are actually resolving the political issues themselves. They've reached a resolution. This is the UN envoy saying this. And then 3 days later, Saudi started bombing. So they don't care about UN resolutions. It means nothing to them.
Do you know what? You've actually worded it really well. So I just, I don't know about you, but I was really upset when things kicked off in Syria. So just to go back in time, that absolute hell has taken place in Libya. I've seen an advanced country being bombed to smithereens based on complete lies. Muslim fundamentalists have been supported by NATO and the West. You've now got slave markets out there in the open air. You've got horrific barbarism going on, all under the watchful guise and gentle nod of the West. And then they shipped all these soldiers by, I think it was via Turkish, big cargo ships to Syria. And then they started saying there was a civil war going on in Syria. And it's like, no, it's not. No, you've just pumped literally 100,000, 150,000 mercenaries from across the Muslim world. You've fanned the flames of sectarianism. And then your complaint is saying that this is a civil war. Am I right or am I wrong? Can you lay down the ground? Because I am quite upset because I really wanted to visit Syria. I love history. I love the fact that it's like a melting pot. You've got Roman, Greek, Assyrian history. Like it goes back to the beginnings of humanity. This cradle of civilization, one of the oldest cities in the world. I wanted to visit it. And then
the cradle of Christianity, because this is where Saul, of course, was converted on the road to Damascus. And there is still a beautiful little chapel that is, I guess, was created by him after his conversion. You can still enter that in Damascus. So, yeah, I mean, this is another thing. They call these countries that were civilized when the West was living in caves. They were having spa baths when the West was kind of, fighting with boneheads and living in caves. I mean, that's the bottom line, right? I mean, how dare you? when they talk about civilization and bringing civilization to these countries, they really don't have any comprehension what they're talking about.
Am I right, though, about the timeline, the leading up to the Syrian crisis? Am I right that it was, people funded from abroad, creating havoc and tension, shooting protesters, blaming it on the army and Assad, and instigating this violence? Or was there a general, resentment and a homegrown movement? What was going on?
No, not really. I mean, of course, like in any country, there is opposition to the government particularly. I would say less so to the president. People tend to see the president here as kind of the red line. They'll criticize the government, and they do so very openly and very vociferously. Any taxi you take will complain for the entire journey. But when it comes to the president, that's kind of a red line. They don't go there. And so people were
that?
Kind of...
Why is that,
because
though?
Because they have basically a huge respect for him. And for his father, of course, for Hafez al-Assad.
They're not scared of him? They're not scared of being popped off?
Honestly, he's the least scary president, I think, in the world today. If you see him after the election in, I think it was May 2021, and Eva was with me then, immediately after he clearly won the election, and of course, too much kind of derision from Western media. But if you saw, despite the sanctions, despite the hardships, the celebrations on the streets, and when he went to Maidan in Damascus, which is an incredibly crowded area, to eat falafel and you know, takeaway, he was completely mobbed by people. Now, someone who's in fear of his people, let's take an example would be Macron. Emmanuel Macron is, I think, by now terrified of going out in public in France.
Yeah.
The president in all the 12 years. And another thing is that he stayed in Damascus. He didn't leave. He stayed even when ISIS were only kilometers away from his residence. He's known to go out at night alone in his car without any bodyguards at all and just drive around Damascus and go home, right? I think wow. The couple themselves, Asma al-Assad, his wife, who, by the way, is Sunni. So when they talk about Sunni Muslim, so, you know, when they talk about Alawite power and that's the reason for the whole uprising, etc., it's kind of nonsense. Because the inclusivity in Syria is really extraordinary.
I was going to say it's beautiful. You know, this is pre-war. My friend, who is a Shia, she's a surgeon. She had been out and she was telling me how wonderful it was. I've given up on my religion, by the way. I'm not a Muslim anymore. I just believe in God. Keep it simple. But she was telling me how amazing it was, multi-ethnic, multi-religious. Mm. And they all just get on. And actually, what they all said they were was Syrian. They were Syrian first.
Yeah, absolutely. That you just gave me goosebumps because that's what everyone says here. It's actually kind of, I still don't ask people what they are because it's an insult, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, there are some places I go to where it's clearly Christian or it's clearly Ismaili or it's clearly Druze, for example. So you don't even have to ask. But even if you ask them, they will immediately say, I'm Syrian. Yeah. First and foremost, I'm Syrian.
And am I right that he's an eye surgeon and he's the most reluctant president because he wasn't groomed to be a president. Assad's father had another son, an older son, and he was meant to be the president. And then he died. And then suddenly this young lad who was trained as an eye surgeon in London in the UK wanted just to be a doctor, suddenly found himself being groomed for this position. I mean, you know, it's not like he was, I want to be a tyrant. I don't think that's what he went to university to do.
I mean, actually, just coming back to the early so-called peaceful protests, I mean, that's when phrases were coined like Christians to Beirut, Alawites to the grave. You would never hear this kind of sectarian language from what I would call real Syrians, real patriotic Syrians. And what you saw were even the opposition members and protesters, once they figured out what was going on, they rallied around the government and around the president because they understood what was happening. So even if they still are in opposition to the government, they understood that this was a much greater threat to the kind of integrity of Syria itself.
So what was happening? Who was the FSU? Who were the Free Syrian, you know, army, FSA or whatever? Who were these people? And I noticed that a lot of them were people who were living abroad and then got called back in and were representing the freedom movement in Syria. Like who were these rebels?
Well, I mean, the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, which was heavily promoted by Obama and his administration, including the then ambassador, Robert Ford, who was in Syria when all the protests broke out and he was regularly caught lying on camera. I mean, it's all archived. So the Free Syrian Army was supposed to be this party of democratic rebels. But in reality, what were they? They were the Muslim Brotherhood factions that had been weaponized by the West against Syria for decades, including in the late 70s, early 80s against Hafez al-Assad. And what was a lot of this about, of course, is Syria's geographical position and Syria's relationship, historic relationship with China and with Russia, which is anathema to the West. You know, what they want is complete control of the Syrian landmass and, of course, plundering of its resources, which is ongoing as we speak. And so for them, I think I've written about the 75 years regime change war against Syria. So since their independence from French mandate in 1946, I've lost count of the number of CIA, MI6 coups and clandestine operations to destabilize governments that were perceived by them as, you know, the ultimate enemy, communists. Because, of course, then it was the Soviet Union that was kind of the reds under the bed type thing. And, yes. And so any relationship with the Soviet Union was deemed to be absolutely, no, that's not going to happen. And so the Muslim Brotherhood was again weaponized from 2011 onwards. There are various CIA and DIA redacted documents that have been published since then demonstrating that that was exactly what they were going to try and do again. I mean, it had basically failed pretty much every time previously. But the West has one big issue, is that it doesn't change its playbook. It you know, it just assumes nobody learns from history.
Well, they're kind of right.
Well, not really, because people here, once they figured out exactly what was going on,
No. I don't mean in Syria. I mean like here.
Oh, you mean
here.
In the West. Yeah,
like
okay.
Here. Like people's memory is like a goldfish.
Yeah.
You know, they don't see what's actually going on. And the funny thing is, you know, in the West now, Vanessa, you've been out for a while, we're all about woke and diversity and look how good we are, virtue signaling, and we're not racist and we're inclusive. So when you go and see a line on which show all the kids are black, because that's the way it was, you know, in the book, you know, it's all tokenism. So, and what I hate about what's going on in the West is it's not really anti-racism. It's superficial bullshit. It's all tokenism.
No, it's pro-racism. And
it is pro-racism. Absolutely. So instead of, oh, wow, I've just got a parrot outside and I'm thinking, what the hell is that doing in South Buckinghamshire at minus 6 degrees? Two of them just, that's the most bizarre thing I've just looked at, right? I normally look out and I see my chickens and instead I see two green parrots and it's like, okay, that's strange. Anyway, what I was saying was it's really quite racist here, right? It's really racist. You know, they want diversity of superficial color, but no diversity of thought. They want to promote people based on their color, but not on their meritocracy, not on their virtues. So, I mean, that's really kind of racist. Like, you're not good enough to have this job, but we'll give it to you because you're the right color. And we need to fill the quotas. But where I was coming to in geopolitics is, you know, there's still this neo-colonial mindset. Oh, we're in the West. We're the good guys. We know what's best. You know, people we don't like, they have regimes. Well, how about, you know, what was going on in Canada and the UK, you know, and during, you know, COVID and all the censorship and the mandates and the lockdowns and the fact that our politicians are corrupt as hell and not accountable. Maybe we've got dictators and regimes. Maybe we're, you know, not the good guys. Maybe we're the bad guys. Maybe we could learn something from the rest of the world. But too many people in this country think, no, we're good. We read The Guardian. You know, we watch the BBC. We're good. We're the right people. And you know what? Those pesky people out there, they don't know how to behave. We need to teach them and tell them how to do things properly. Racist. That's racist.
Well, I mean, and also, as you said, the people of color that are put into power are usually the most racist. You've only got to look at Suella Braverman, Priti Patel, even Rishi Sunak. I was just going to look for the name of the Muslim MP that was speaking out about the escalation by the UK against Yemen and the inability, apparently, to create a ceasefire in Gaza. And he basically stood up. He didn't even really recognize her arguments, which I thought were very pertinent. He just said, well, if the Right Honorable Lady is going to put the blame. She should put it on Hamas. And he just sat down again, just like that. There's no respect for her opinion. It's extraordinary. You know,
it's unbelievable.
And as I said, Braverman and Priti Patel were, I mean, my God, they put through some of the most racist policies possible. If you look at Rwanda, if you look at, you know, the treatment of vulnerable refugees, you know, where I think Braverman was saying that organizations that were providing tents should be fined for providing tents for refugees that had arrived in Britain. I mean, this is
really,
yeah.
Wow. By the way, can I just quickly ask something? Don't mind. Sorry, isn't that terrible? Anyway, so going back to Syria, I think this idea that, you know what, there's a regime and they're bad and they're dictators, it's just so childish and immature, but it sticks because, you know, like every insult, if you just say it oftentimes enough, you know, people start to believe it. But I have looked into potentially why the war happened. And like for a lot of reasons, it's multifactorial. And if you speak to people like Ed Griffin, he tells me all wars are banker wars. You know, they're just profiting from this. But I read somewhere, and I'm not sure if this is right or not, but Iran, Iraq, and Syria wanted to make a friendship pipeline. So Iran and Iraq were at war for years. Now they've made peace. They wanted to sell gas and oil to the Mediterranean, to the European countries. And by creating this pipeline, everyone was going to profit. Iraq was going to profit for transit fees. Syria was going to profit for transit fees. You'd have the port at Tartus. Straight away, you're out into Greece and Italy and the rest of Europe. Now, the vested interests that were really against this were Turkey, who wants to sell things for Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Russia, and they had this South pipeline, and equally Israel, who wants to sell their gas for, and you know, for the Leviathan, and they want to deal with UAE, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. So all these players backed with America and the UK were like, yeah, we can't let this happen. So we are going to absolutely destroy Syria, create a war, create instability, and this thing won't happen. And interestingly, Netanyahu only a few months ago was putting up a picture of a pipeline running from Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. And it's like, oh, fancy that. I mean, do you think there's much truth in that?
Actually, that's the India-Middle East economic corridor. So it runs from Mumbai through Saudi Arabia, I think UAE, Haifa, and then into Europe, still bypassing Turkey, by the way. There's also talk of the reason that they basically destroyed most of northern Gaza is to revive the Ben-Gurion Canal project, which, again, will cut the Suez Canal out of the picture. I'm not entirely convinced of how realistic that is, because I can't remember how many nuclear it's needed in order to create the hole for the water to go into to create the Ben-Gurion Canal. But I think what is a very real target is the gas resources off the coast of Lebanon, Syria, and of course Gaza. And Gaza, since its discovery, has never been allowed to actually exploit its own resources. Of course not. It's been controlled by British Petroleum and various others, and of course the Israelis. And so for me, this is the biggest target, and the control of the strategic ports. Because you mentioned Tartus, but actually really in Syria, the main port is Latakia.
Yeah.
And Latakia is effectively still under the control of Erdogan, Turkey, and his proxy militia, because it isn't really, but access, let me say access to Latakia is still controlled very much by Erdogan, because he has control of north of the, I think it's the M4, which runs from Aleppo to Damascus. He has control of the north. And so basically that cuts off any access from the M4 to Latakia. He doesn't have control of Latakia itself. But at the same time, his terrorists are constantly targeting northern Latakia, for example, especially now since October the 7th. The activity from the terrorist groups in Syria has massively increased in solidarity with Israel, which was inevitable, as I said, because Israel was known to have funded and armed them.
So can you just repeat that last line again? Did I hear you correct?
Which?
That the terrorists have increased their activity?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And they always have done throughout the 12-year. No, it's now losing count. It's now nearly 15 years. No, 14 years.
So I thought there was a truce now. Isn't there a truce? Isn't there peace there? In Syria?
No, of course not. It's an ongoing bubbling cauldron because basically the US has control of almost the entire northeast from the Euphrates east to Iraq. There's only one crossing between Syria and Iraq that remains open, and which is Al Bukamal, and the US has expressed an agenda to take control of that, and that's why it regularly bombs Al Bukamal, because it's the main land route from Iran through Iraq and into Syria to bring humanitarian relief and oil and, military assistance.
So we talk about Russia, the big bad Russians taking over Ukraine and illegally taking over. What the hell is America doing occupying?
No, it doesn't end there, because in the southeast, so if you come down along the border with Jordan, they have one of the biggest U.S. military bases, illegal military bases, at Al-Talam,
yeah.
Yeah, which has been training terrorist groups, various factions, but including ISIS, for years, and providing them with HIMARS, providing them with weapons and equipment and funding and protection, because the US, can you believe this, inside Syria, around Al-Tanf, has created a 55-kilometer exclusion zone. So Syrians and Russians are not allowed inside that 55-kilometer exclusion zone. So ISIS can dip out, carry out attacks against the Syrian Arab army or against civilians, as it did in 2018 in Sweida in the south, the Druze community, where it massacred hundreds, and then return to the exclusion zone around Al-Tanf because it knows it can't be pursued.
So the Americans
are
not
only providing arms, it's providing protection.
So they're protecting, the Americans are protecting the Muslim fundamentalists, militants.
Yeah, it's another proxy. I mean, the pretext is for the US to be in Syria to fight ISIS. But the reality is they have, I think, in the region of between 10,000 and 15,000, I would need to check that, in holding camps that they call, prisons in the northeast. But they ferry them around by helicopter back into Iraq, for example, to carry out attacks against Iraqi electrical installations and so on. So to, prevent Iraqis from being able to live with dignity and so on. This is what the US does, and it's what it does to its own people. We saw that during COVID. It shouldn't be any great surprise to us, really. And then in the north, of course, you have Turkey, and it's rebranded Free Syrian Army, so Muslim Brotherhood, because Turkey is one of the big benefactors of Muslim Brotherhood, along with Qatar, that invested billions in the regime change war, as did Saudi, but Saudi kind of pulled out around 2017. I think it saw the writing on the wall after Russia came in September 2015 and started to drive ISIS back into the northeast, because it had achieved huge gains actually inside Syria, and it was a tipping moment for the war against Syria at that point. And then in the northwest you have the US assets, which is Al-Qaeda, which has been described by I think it was Ambassador Jeffries that described them as an asset to the US, Jake Sullivan in a 2012 email to Hillary Clinton, basically stated that Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. you know, so, and Al-Qaeda also comes from the same Muslim Brotherhood route, actually, again, with huge funding from Qatar, not so much from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia funded actually the more extremist Wahhabi groups, including ISIS and Sheikh Abdullah Muhaizani, who was responsible for some of the most heinous crimes when he was the leader of the alliance known as Fatah al-Sham, and trained child suicide bombers and carried out really some of the worst atrocities that were all funded by Saudi Arabia. And then in the south, of course, you now have this, well, you have the Israeli illegal occupation of the Golan territory since 67, which was the same time that it took control of areas of the West Bank and Gaza, of course, illegally. That's why it doesn't actually have the right to self-defense, because it's an occupying force.
Imagine Britain had most of Scotland occupied by Russia, Cornwall occupied by China, and East Anglia occupied by North Korea.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then every single time an Iran comes in and takes a bit of Wales. and they've got no legal...
all your water, all your oil, all your agricultural produce. And so effectively starves the Syrian peoples, deprives them of any energy. I mean, I talked to you before we came on about electricity. Here, I'm relatively good. I have 4 hours off and 2 hours on. But most
and then
of
imagine
and then, hour in 24 hours.
And then imagine the Chinese and Russian complain that the English don't like them, the British don't like them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ludicrous. You know, we go to other countries, carve them up, destroy them, make their lives misery, orphan generations of children, thousands of them, kill their parents, parents lose their children. You know, I mean, I've got three kids. The idea of losing even one just would break me, you know. And we do this. We do this in an industrial scale.
Yeah.
And then we wonder why countries don't like us and why people don't like us. And it's not Muslim fundamentalism. People have got in the West really, really need to wake up to this. You know, they listen to certain people. I'm not going to mention names, but they go, oh, there's a clash of civilization. And there's a conference here, an ARC conference. And one of the speakers said, the barbarians aren't just at the gates, they're inside. And it's like, listen to yourselves. Really? We're the barbarians. No, we're the ones causing havoc.
And it's not even the people, you know, because the people in Syria always differentiate between the people of a country in the West and the government or the regime of a country in the West. So actually, if you, as a British citizen, came to Syria, the doors would be thrown open to you, right? Actually, the same in Palestine. This is one message that I've really been trying to get across. One is the resistance is not purely Islamist. There are Palestinian Christians that are opposed to Zionism. There are Palestinian Jews that are opposed to Zionism. There are Palestinian communists that are opposed to Zionism. Exactly as they try to present Yemen as just the Houthis, which I think is less than 1% of the population, by the way, that's how ridiculous it is. I mean, that makes them look stupid if you think that 1% of the Yemeni population is going to be able to reduce the US to a quivering wreck in the Red Sea. Because it has. I mean, they're now talking, having played their trumpet of providing protection for the shipping. They've now basically said to the shipping, no, I don't think you should actually go through the Red Sea. It's not a good idea. So where's their protection? You know, the thing is, in my view, what Ukraine has shown us, what Palestine has shown us, is that these countries who've portrayed themselves as supremacist, exceptionalist nations, super forces, I wouldn't say superpowers, super forces, have actually been revealed to be paper tigers, because the whole of NATO didn't succeed in Ukraine, despite sending hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians to their death. And I mean, we're seeing more and more videos of soldiers basically refusing to go to the front, right? In even in Gaza, the IOF, the Israeli forces, have not won the ground war. They've lost it. They're basically leaving northern Gaza. They've suffered huge numbers of casualties and injuries, which, of course, they're not declaring publicly. But it's obvious from the number of attacks that are being very well documented and archived by the resistance factions, both in southern Lebanon and in Palestine.
Really? Oh, you don't.
How can they win?
This?
How can they win an urban warfare inside the Gaza enclave, which they know nothing about? And the resistance are fighting for their existence. They're fighting for something they ideologically believe in, whether they're Islamists or Christians, or it doesn't matter. It's their land. And so for them, this is a battle for survival. Now, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister for Israel, has also made the point that if we don't have victory, how can we survive in the Middle East? So it's very clear, just as Ukraine and Russia is an existential battle, basically against NATO, it's the same for Palestine and Israel. Each one is fighting for its survival in the Middle East, and one is definitely losing.
Yeah, I've been following what's going on in Ukraine, and it's just a meat grinder. And I think the Russians have been playing a very clever tactic of just sit there and let the troops fall on their bayonets. And it's like, if you listen to the Western media, it's how Putin is mad, how everyone hates him, how the soldiers
Everyone's
are being ripped
mad
up.
If they're not in the West.
Yeah, exactly. How Russia's facing massive defeat, and Putin's not popular anymore. And then you read the Russian side, and it's like, there's videos of every single NATO military equipment torched, burnt to the ground, and thousands of dead Ukrainians. I mean, I think it's something like 400,000 now. And you're like, hold on one second. And Russia keeps gaining land, and Ukraine keeps losing, and Ukraine keeps asking for more weapons, and they're running out. This isn't adding up. The narrative I'm hearing from the West doesn't seem to be correct. It seems like Russia's winning. And the propaganda is strong. It's the lies are so, I mean, and I'm not saying Russia doesn't lie and Russia doesn't have propaganda and everybody does, but I'm just saying the idea that we're the good guys and we tell nothing but the truth and we're always on the side of right is not the case. And you know what? It's quite sad. I remember when I first realized this, it's kind of sad. You know, I grew up in the 80s. I watched all the movies. I thought we were the good guys. And then you suddenly realize actually that's not the case. You know, our governments are rotten.
And they've been rotten for centuries, actually. The US has been rotten since its establishment as a genocidal settler state. There's no other way to describe it. It doesn't have a civilization, or it's an incredibly young civilization, so it doesn't have an understanding of foreign culture, foreign civilization. And that's why it thinks that it can just ride roughshod in on these countries and destroy them and massacre them and slaughter them. And nobody's going to care because they're brown. And because the media has done this kind of massive dehumanization campaign, they call it the Hitlerization of the target president or leader. And then you have the dehumanization of, for example, any Syrian that still supports the president. It was quite incredible. These Syrians didn't exist. And that's one reason that kind of drove me and Eva to come here and a number of others like Shamin Nawani, who was here from 2012, another great journalist, to actually come here and see for ourselves and to actually transmit the voices of the disappeared, because that's what they do. They disappear the voices in opposition to the West. They Hitlerize the leaders in opposition to the West, because you also have to remember Assad, Russian pipeline over the Qatari pipeline, which was, I mean, that was already his death knell as regards, complying with the West. You have to remember the Bush-Blair emails or communications that were revealed in the report about 9/11.
Can you just give me one second?
Target.
Yeah. Tell me about the Blair-Bush emails.
Well, I mean, there were a number of them, basically suggesting that they would try for a different relationship with Syria. In other words, they would try to bring Syria into the fold and persuade Assad that it was a really good idea to do everything that the West wanted. Basically, I think one of the Blair emails was, look, we can't target Iraq and Syria at the same time. Let's try and, cajole Assad into coming onto our side. And if that doesn't work, as we know from the French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, who admitted in 2013 that in 2009, British officials were approaching him to tell him, okay, like we need you to come on board because we're going to basically start an armed insurgency in Syria because clearly Assad isn't going to do what we want, right? And one of the reasons he didn't do what they want was because he favored Iran and Russia as historic allies over Qatar. And then, of course, you had Assad's Four Seas project in 2004, which was the start of Syria looking into multipolarity and creating these, as you mentioned, the Iran-Iraq pipeline, the Belt and Road Initiative from China, various initiatives, as Syria being the hub for supply into Europe. And then, of course, the final thing was that he refused to abandon his allies. He refused to abandon the Palestinian cause. He refused to abandon Hezbollah. And so everything pointed to this happening. I think it was in 2005 that Christiane Amanpour interviewed him of CNN, in my view, just unpleasant journalist. But she interviewed him and actually threatened him with regime change. In 2005, in 2006, there was a Time article, I think it was written by Bush, Syria in Bush's crosshairs. And Bush was already talking about enabling an insurgence in Syria. So, this isn't rocket science. It's very easy to go back through historical evidence that this was planned really from 9/11 onwards.
Yeah, and I think if I was a leader of any country in the world and a Western country like America or Britain said, come on and be our friend and we'll take care of you. What would come to my mind? What would come to my mind is, do you remember that meeting in the desert with Gaddafi? I think it was with Tony Blair. And the rapprochement and how they were besties and they were best friends. Look what they did to Gaddafi. He got a bayonet shoved up his ass. And he did everything the West said. Like he said, right, I'll be your friend. I'll open up the economy and blah, blah, blah. How did that end for him? And any leader around the world now, I think with just two brain cells just needs to look at how the West treats its friends to think, do you know what? I'll pass on this one. So I don't blame Assad.
The assassination of Qasem Soleimani in 2020 under the Trump administration in Baghdad. Now, according to many reports based on intelligence, Trump actually enticed Soleimani to Baghdad to carry out a diplomatic role with Saudi Arabia. In other words, you know, repairing relations with Saudi Arabia. And then he was killed. And he wasn't only killed. The head of the PMU, the Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhammad, was also killed in the attack. Now, this was a guy, I met him in 2017.
Wow.
He was a visionary. He was an engineer by trade. And we had a very kind of long, hour-long, maybe more, interview with him, with a whole media delegation. And he was the one that spoke about the inclusivity, the secular nature of the PMU. It wasn't only Shia. It wasn't backed by Iran. It's not an Iranian proxy. It's Iraqi, and it's very proud of being Iraqi. The thing is, by calling everything or every nation an Iranian proxy, you reduce their own agency. And of course, this is deliberate, right? The same way with calling them the Houthis, but then also saying the Iran-backed Houthis. It's just like, no, this is an entire resistance movement, Ansarullah, that has basically warded off the US and Saudi Arabia and UAE and Israel for
8 years. Can I just say something? Vanessa, you and I know this is all bullshit. We know American and British and Western policy in the Middle East and pretty much everywhere in the world is hypocritical, devious, deceitful, and basically outright lies, right? And then a complete inversion of truth and reality. The problem is most of the population in the West, I don't think, understands this or appreciates this. They just know the ragheads and the Muslims, you know, are barbaric and want to kill them all and kill all Jews and kill all Muslims and take over. When actually they don't. Most of them just want to eat falafel and have a good time and look after their families. And they love their kids just as much as we love our kids. And actually, any Muslim fundamentalist is being actually supported and sponsored by the West.
Exactly.
I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood was even funded by the MI6 and American and Western British intelligence agencies. So we've got a hand in this whole radicalization of Islam. I mean, my mom grew up in Pakistan and she remembers as a kid, you know, like it wasn't very religious. Girls just had a scarf or shawl around their necks. You know, she goes back now and she goes, I don't understand what's happened to that country. She goes, you know, what's happened? It's all radicalized. And who's radicalizing it? All the Saudi Wahhabi, you know, leaders and mosques. And who's been Saudi Arabia's number one ally? Britain and America. We supported them. We've promoted them. We funded them.
Well,
we created them.
Exactly.
I know that. Exactly. We've created them, right? We got the most, you know, minor sect in Islam, the most radical, extreme version of Islam, and we give them all the money and power. Like, why would you do that? Why? But like, imagine getting the most extreme version of Christianity, the most fundamentalist, racist, horrible, like where most Christians are like, that's not really us. We're not like that. And then pushing them to represent all of Christianity. That's what all the listeners need to understand.
You know,
whatever.
Because again, that's something that has been very much created by the West in conjunction with the creation of the Zionist settler colonial state, which was a British project, after all, that began in the late 1880s. And continued until the Balfour Declaration in 1917. Of course, the Sykes-Picot, which sort of balkanized most of the Middle East prior to that. And then the withdrawal of the British and the UN partitioning of Palestine in 1947, which then led to the ethnic cleansing in 1948. And in my view, it hasn't stopped since then. It's been a continuous, ongoing ethnic cleansing and reduction of Palestinian rights and justice. And even, I mean, how can you take control of a country and then not allow the indigenous people to return to it? You know, anyone who declares themselves Jewish in any country gets a free pass to enter Israel, but not a Palestinian.
No.
marvels of Syria.
I know. So can I just ask, look, I want to quickly ask you something about Iran and Syria. Look, it can't all be, they're all wonderful. I mean, I personally don't believe in any theocracy or religious-based state, whether it's a Zionist Jewish exclusive state or a Christian state or a Muslim state. I'm sorry, I'm very libertarian. I believe in small governments, if none at all, to be honest. I'm becoming an anarchist. And I certainly don't want a religion. I certainly don't want anarchy, and not in the sense of chaos.
Yeah,
I know. The original version of anarchy. I don't really want a state being a religious state and telling me how to practice. I mean, what is it like in Iran and Syria? Are these very religious countries? Are they very strict? Is it
no?
What are they like?
No, my God, Iran is the same. I mean, I spent 2 weeks there at the beginning of last year, just after all the furor about the death of the girl in prison, when in reality she had a heart attack and they took her to hospital and so on, and she died there, where she had heart problems. So I spent two weeks there, and actually, I mean, Iran is the same. I mean, it's a vast country with an incredibly diverse population. I mean, I visited Jews, I visited Christians, I visited areas where they don't wear hijab. And it's ridiculous. If you're walking around in Tehran center, the majority of women are not wearing hijab, by the way.
Oh, wow. But what about the modesty police? Aren't the modesty police coming out after them?
The most they will do is just pull a scarf up over their head if they see the modesty police. But I honestly didn't see any crackdown on women wearing or not wearing hijab anywhere. In the markets, in the mall, nobody was wearing it. Nobody.
Right. Wow.
So, and Fiorella Isabel, who's a colleague of mine, a journalist now based in Moscow, she said the same thing. She went to Iran, I think, later in 2023, and she said exactly the same thing. It's kind of nonsense, And Syria is ridiculously secular. If you go into the old city on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday night, you would think you're in Paris.
Wow.
You'll see hijabis and you'll see girls in outrageous miniskirts and low-cut tops and free-flowing hair, and all of them smoking shisha outside the disco or outside the nightclub. It kind of makes me laugh. A dear colleague of mine said to me the other day, "So do you celebrate Christmas in Syria?" I'm like, what?
Sorry, my daughter just moved the camera.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
We have actually Catholic Christmas and Orthodox Christmas. So we have two Christmases.
Amazing.
And two Easters. And the funniest thing is, if you go out onto the streets during Christmas, so you have all the trees and the decorations, there's more Muslims taking selfies in front of the Christmas trees than Christians. It's the most wonderful, diverse society.
So, my dad came over to this country, Scotland. I don't live in Scotland anymore. I just live outside London. But, I'm British, Scottish. And when he came over when he was 16, 17, he was still a Muslim. But we would celebrate and have Christmas trees and Christmas presents.
Yeah.
And he would say to me, this is Jesus is a prophet of God, and we should celebrate and we should have a great time and we should integrate with the country. And, yes, I was brought up religious, but it was just, we were never taught that everyone else is bad or all that kind of stuff.
No.
We were taught to love the people of the book, especially
in all of these countries. I mean, here in Syria, I don't know if you know, but in an area kind of to the northwest of Damascus, there's the most, it's called the Christian Valley, and there's a tiny monastery, and inside the monastery is the letter that Prophet Muhammad wrote to his followers to say, you will protect the Christians, you will treat them like your brothers, you will respect them, and you will take care of them.
Wow.
And this war has completely proven this fact, you know. Those Christians, if you look at the Syrian Arab Army makeup, it's made up of every single minority and inside Syria, Sunni, Shia, Alawite, Christian, Druze, Yazidi.
Can Ismaili. I just say something? Isn't that beautiful then, that despite almost the whole weight of the West and the world trying to tear them apart and make them fight each other, they've said, no, we're not going to let this happen to us. That's kind of amazing.
And even, you know, the Christians that were actually probably, along with the Alawites and the Shia, probably the most targeted, because the West has an agenda to get the Christians out of the Middle East. So it can create these kind of sectarian divides without the Christian buffer, if you, for want of a better phrase. The Christians were the most targeted in many of the cities and in the Christian communities in northern Hama on the border with Idlib. I spent many nights there under attack from Al-Qaeda. 500, can you imagine this? 500 meters away. I could see Al-Qaeda checkpoints from the restaurant we were sitting in.
Wow.
And the rocket attacks were almost on a daily basis. Of course, targeting schools, hospitals, children, never mentioned in Western media.
I'm gonna talk about this targeting in a second. I wanted to say, you know, they don't want Jews and Christians living in these countries in the Middle East because it goes against the whole bullshit narrative that they've got, that these are Muslim fundamentalist countries that hate us. That this is a war of civilizations and religions, and that we in the West are enlightened and they are barbaric. And then when you realize that actually it's all cosmopolitan and they're living side by side and have been for centuries. And, you know, I've had, you know, Rabbi Weiss on my podcast, and he was talking about, you know, Jews and Muslims and Christians lived happily in Palestine for centuries.
Yeah.
They lived like neighbors. And so this idea that the Zionists promote, which is that, you know, they want to kill all the Jews and there's no homeland for the Jews. There's nowhere safe for the Jews and they're coming for them. And the Palestinians want to eradicate them. It's all a lie. It's all a lie. And the funny is, you know, but they need that as a pretext, an excuse to then vilify. And you need the bogeyman. And it's very easy to make the Muslim fundamentalist bogeyman, you know, the scary Muslim. And I say this as someone who was an ex-Muslim. You know, never once did we ever hate anyone else. I never met another Muslim who hated other people. I just didn't. No. I don't know where they get these people from, by the way. And
well,
you know,
the Islamists that are kind of weaponized by the West are a distorted, perverted version of Islam. But the point is that it's created by the West. It doesn't represent Islam, right? And in Palestine, 100%. I mean, like Eva, I spent time in Gaza in 2012-2013. You know, I witnessed a 13-year-old boy, Hamid Abu Dagha, being mowed down by a Zionist helicopter outside his house, just playing football, just killed. And I remember speaking to the family on numerous occasions, and I remember one time asking the father, I mean, the family was destroyed, of course. You know, he was an amazing little boy, but from what I heard from them. But I remember asking the father, what would you say if you could talk to the Zionist who killed your son?
Mm.
He started crying. There was no anger. He just said to me, I just don't understand. Don't they have children? Mm. And that really like stayed with me for years, because that's generally how Palestinians think. They can't understand this inhumanity. They can't understand this mowing down, this massacre of children, of babies. And, you know, before anybody brings up October the 7th, I mean, the Israeli media has largely discredited most of the stories and proven that Israel itself carried out attacks against its own civilians and probably caused the majority of
Vanessa, I also think I want to take this opportunity to correct that. You know how a lot of the West, you know, the governments and officials want to paint this homogenous kind of blob, all Iranians are the same, all the Middle East are the same, all the Muslims are the same, and, you know, the Hutus or whatever. It's also not the case that the Jews are all the same. They want to make it like all Jews are Zionists and blah, blah. I have a lot of Jewish friends. I've had quite a lot of Jewish people on my podcast, and they've made it very clear. They don't agree with anything that's happening in Israel. And the American Jews in particular, they're like, actually, if you think about it, the idea of saying that, Israel is the Jewish homeland, actually, we find that quite offensive because I'm American. I'm a Jew who is an American. And if you're trying to tell me, actually, that's my homeland and I don't belong here, this is not my home, my home is only there, I find that really offensive. And I get that. Mm-hmm. And I've had, you know, Dan Cohen now, and his podcast is going to come out in the next week or two. You know, he's as Jewish as you can get. And he's like, this isn't in my name. This is wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important we make this clear that, you know, there are a lot of really good Jewish people out there who do not agree with what's going on. But actually, a lot of them are even scared to speak up, though. Because just like, for example, take my medical community, my doctors, right? So many doctors know, for example, the vaccines are causing harms, but they're too scared to say anything. They know what will happen if they do. Look at me. I've just lost my job. I've lost my career. And they're absolutely terrified of putting their head above the parapet. Now, you can say whatever you want, and I've got issues saying, look, we need to be brave. We need to stand up and call out the BS. But I can understand why you would be scared to do that. And I know a lot of Jewish people who are, I can't say what I think. If I say what I think, I'll be totally ostracized. I'll be ostracized by my community.
But I think seeing a massive sea change in that, especially even in the younger generation of Zionists, young Zionists that were brought up by a Zionist family are now really turning against the Zionist project. I mean, if you looked, there was the sit-in at the AIPAC building with young Jews basically saying, you don't speak for us. That's extraordinary. You wouldn't have seen that.
Oh, wow. Like
a few years ago. Yeah, it was in the last few days. I mean, I was like, wow, you know, and there's more and more young Zionists coming out on TikTok or whatever, like basically saying, you know, this is bullshit. I don't believe in it anymore. I've been lied to. And there was a really good documentary that was made quite recently, and I can't remember the title, which went into the indoctrination in Israel of even from kindergarten up, right, into the Zionist ideology. So it's not really surprising that, as Alistair Crook said, who's a former British diplomat, 80 to 90% of Israelis believe that the government should be doing more to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians. But it's not surprising when you look at the level of indoctrination. I'll try and find I can easily find the documentary. It's just the title of it has escaped me for now.
So I got an email from one of my listeners and supporters. I was trying to find it. And he basically said, look, you know what? I've listened to one of your podcasts, but, you know, if the Muslims and the Palestinians have their way from the river to the sea, you know, what's going to happen to all the Jews? They're all going to get killed. And, you know, and for that sake, we need to kind of like defend them. What do you think of that argument?
I'm sorry, but I think it's nonsense. Because as you said, pre-Zionism, and by the way, when Theodor Herzl began the Zionist cult in the late 1880s, it was described by many Jews as an anti-Semitic cult. The most anti-Semitic entity is Zionism.
I found
and
it.
A return yes. to... A return to a Palestinian state, one state with no borders, but with Christians and Jews and Palestinians living side by side, with the dismantlement of the Zionist project. That has to happen for that to become a reality. Because pre 1917, as you said, Jews and Palestinians were living equably side by side. I mean, I have an extraordinary thesis by a young Jewish guy that describes, because through speaking to his grandmother, he actually discovered what life was like pre the Nakba and so on. And it's a beautiful thesis, actually, because he goes into huge detail about how neighbors helped neighbors, about how there was no sectarianism, there was complete unity as a nation, and people live side by side. You know, this isn't a fantasy. this is reality. This is what happened.
Yeah. Can I quickly read out the email? I found it, right? So this is from Andy. He's a good guy, right? And I think he represents a lot of people in the West. And this is why I think it's really important we kind of like respond to this. Thanks, Ahmed. I started listening to your podcast with Norman Fenton and will finish it in due course. It boils down to a simple question. Can the world stand to have one small Jewish state? If the Palestinians succeed in clearing the Jews from the river to the sea, we all know that the land would become yet another Muslim state. Does the world really need that? The area of Palestine had populations of Druze, Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and in Gaza and the West Bank, the Muslims kill or expel everyone else. If the Palestinians laid down their arms, there would be peace. If the Israelis did the same, there would be genocide. For that reason, I think we would have to support Israel's right to exist. Now, how would you respond to that?
Well, the state of Israel, the Zionist settler colonialist entity that was created by Britain and then adopted by the US as their military garrison in the Middle East to create chaos in the Middle East among perfectly peaceful Muslim countries, has committed a genocide since 1948. 750,000 Palestinians ethnically cleansed in 1948, multiple rapes, multiple massacres, multiple mass executions. I mean, you talk about hostages. How many Palestinian hostages in military jail? Because, by the way, they don't go to civilian jail, they go to military jail, and they can be kept there without charge for decades. Decades. And you're talking 5,000 plus the ones that they've taken since October 7th. The disappeared from Gaza. Thousands just disappeared from Gaza. The claims, the documentation of the theft of organs from Palestinians, both killed and alive, the desecration of dead bodies of Palestinians, the refusal to release Palestinian bodies back to their families, which is another desecration of Muslim beliefs and dignity. And this is a daily occurrence. Diana, can I just finish? Yeah. Diana Butu, who's an international lawyer based in Palestine, as she said, you know, these genocidal intent comments, and there's an organization called Palestine Law for Palestine that has accrued 500 genocidal intent statements from the prime minister, from the president, from the military commanders, from the soldiers themselves, from all manner of officials within the far-right extremist regime, including from the heritage minister, who called for the nuking of Gaza. So when we're talking about genocide, the Muslims have never carried out genocide. The Muslims that might have carried out genocide are those that are backed by the West, funded by the West, and armed by the West to massacre Muslims in countries that don't comply with their agenda, their regional geopolitical agenda. So it's kind of I would only say that you've been extremely misled if you think that Muslims are the problem here, because I've just spent like almost an hour and a half describing societies in Iran, in Iraq, in Palestine. Here the Palestinians just want an end to apartheid, an end to inequality, an end to genocide and ethnic cleansing. Look at what's going on in West Bank, quietly under the radar. There's no Hamas in West Bank. And by the way, Palestine, as it was, as I've said, was an inclusive state. inclusive of Christians, inclusive of Jews, and inclusive of Muslims, inclusive of atheists, inclusive of communists. Exactly like Syria, exactly like every country that the West has tried to destroy.
100%.
So, you know, I can only say, please educate yourself, because this really isn't the reality from on the ground.
Vanessa, I think that's a great answer. And I'm going to add a little bit, if that's okay, Vanessa, and you can give me marks out of 10. So Andy, what I would say is, it doesn't boil down to the simple question, can the world stand to have one small Jewish state? You can't create a little Overton window like that. You can't just create, this is the question. No, it's not. That's not the question. I would say, why do we have to have a Jewish state or a Muslim state? I would say, you could even then boil it down to this question. Can the world stand to have a small colonial apartheid state? Exactly. Can the world stand to have a racist state? You know, I don't think that's the question. So I think if you're going to pitch that question, you'll get the wrong answer. So no, that is not the question. And I don't think the Palestinians... I don't think the Palestinians want to clear the Jews from the river to the sea. I don't think they've ever said that. I think they just want to have a state that's from the river to the sea. And this idea that they want to clear the Jews from the area is actually wrong and incorrect. So again, that needs to be clarified. And then you said, you know, does the land need yet another Muslim state? I agree. I don't think we need any more Muslim states, Christian states, or any states that are religious based, frankly. And the reality is, why would it be a Muslim state? Why could it not be a secular state? You know, do we talk about France as a Christian state? Or Poland, Christian? What, we never talk about any Western country and say they're Christian, Russian Christian state or Chinese Confucian state. Why do we always have to label these as a Muslim state? Maybe these countries are just countries and they happen to have Muslim majorities, just like a lot of countries in the West do. But we don't label them with this, you know, tagline. So let's not use these terms. The area of Palestine had populations of Jews, Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Absolutely. They did historically for centuries. Why can't they today and tomorrow? There's no reason why they wouldn't. And no, the Muslims are not going to kill or expel anyone. They had their chance for thousands of years and they didn't do that. So why now? And actually, if you want to look at where Jews were at risk and harmed the most by their millions, it was in the West under the guise and supervision of the Christians, not the Muslims. That's where the Holocaust happened. And actually, if you look at, you know, Spain, and, you know, the expulsions from Spain and the persecution of Jews there, where did they all flee? They fled to Muslim countries because that's where they had sanctuary. So this idea that Muslim countries and Muslims want to kill them is historically wrong. It's wrong. They were actually persecuted in Western Christian countries and they sought refuge in the Muslim countries. So from a historical point of view, it just doesn't add up. If the Palestinians laid down their arms, there would be peace. Incorrect. Actually, under the British Mandate, they laid down their weapons and the Jewish settlers didn't. And then look what happened to them. So when the British disarmed the Palestinians, they then were expelled from their homelands and they became a displaced people. So when has laying down your arms ever been good for anybody? And the answer is not for the Palestinians to stop resisting. They're resisting occupation. Like I said, if Russia, China, or whatever, North Korea came over to Britain, do you not think it would be our right to resist and fight and defend? I think so. So, you know, the whole argument is pitched the wrong way, Andy. And I think you need to go away. I mean, listen to Jeremy Hammond's podcast with me, and he talks about how the Arabs, the Muslims and the Christians, didn't resist Israeli independence. They resisted what the Jewish Zionists were saying. The Jewish Zionists were saying, we want an exclusive Jewish state. And the Arabs were like, no, let's not have a Muslim or a Jewish state or a Christian state. Let's just have Palestine, one land for all the people. And when the Zionists refused this, that's when the Arabs rebelled and fought back and said, no, this is not what we want. And Israel actually unilaterally said, we are independent and this is the country of Israel, despite the fact that the majority of people living in it were like, no. So I think people need to know their history, and there's too much propaganda and brainwashing going on. And the reality is, I think I think it was Dan and I were saying on our podcast, Vanessa, I don't know if you agree with this, but the problem is complex. There's a lot of history. And the reason why there's complexity is because of the lies and propaganda. Once you get rid of all the lies and propaganda, actually, the problem is quite easy. You've got a group of people who've come over, European, white, and said, this is our land and we're taking it and we're shoving everyone else off it. And that is the problem in a nutshell. But the solution is actually very simple now. The solution is you have one land for all the people, not exclusively special for any group of people, not for any religion, not a religious state, just one republic for all the people to live equally. And that's it. What would you say to that, Vanessa?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the two-state solution, in fact, the Peel Commission in 1936 dismissed the two-state solution. So even as far back as then, it was not viable. And the one-state solution is the only way forward, with complete equality, no more apartheid, no more racism, no more summary executions and you know, destruction and building of settlements. I mean, since October the 7th, even Israeli NGOs have been reporting a massive increase in settlements in Palestinian land in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. And if you go back, he can, you know, what's his name? Andy. Check out Daniela Weiss. Because if you listen to her, there's a documentary called Stone Cold Justice. And in that, she talks how in the 70s, it was with Ariel Sharon a definite plan to make absolutely certain that the Palestinians could never have an independent state. So the building of the settlements was deliberate to prevent a unified Palestinian state. And that's why it's broken up into these cantons that are shrinking. And since October the 7th, what have they been doing? Destroying bridges, destroying roads, destroying mosques, destroying hospitals, schools, houses in the West Bank under the radar because everybody's kind of focusing on Gaza. But this is what has been going on. You only have to look at the map of Palestine, right, from 1948 onwards to see how it was carved up. How would people in England feel if suddenly, I don't know, Yorkshire was suddenly carved out of the UK and given to another state. And that ceased to be Yorkshire. It ceased to be British. It became whatever state, right? How would people feel about that? Whatever.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? People are not empathizing. They're not putting themselves into the shoes of the Palestinians. They're putting 100%. Themselves into the shoes that are being given to them by Western media that routinely lies, deceives, manipulates the truth in order to basically justify Western hegemony globally.
You nailed it, Vanessa. You absolutely freaking nailed it. Ah, you nailed it. Oh, God, you know what? I just wish the central bankers would go away. Then all the climate scam bullshit would go away. The vaccines would go away. The pharma bullshit would go away. All the perverse incentives would go away. The wars would go away. I mean, humanity could just heal. It's the bankers and the money. And you know what? I've realized in the past, you know, they used to attack the, you know, Middle East and all Africa and rape their land and sow discord and havoc. You know what? The predator class is doing it to the West now. Vanessa, they're doing it here. They're destroying, they're eating, hollowing us out. And I think people need to realize this. People need to realize that the little brown person halfway around the world isn't the problem.
In fact, they're demonstrating what resistance should be, by the way. This is what I keep saying. They're actually on the front lines of resistance. They're living in the dystopia that the West wants to impose upon Westerners. And until we wake up to this, that our regimes have actually created dystopia already in these countries, and we recognize their need for liberation in order for us to be a cohesive resistance force against the predator class, we're going to be endlessly divided. And that's what they want.
100%. What do you think about these mass? Okay, then one final question. I was going to ask you about mass migration. We can do that another time. Very quickly, look, you're on your deathbed. You've lived over 100, very healthy, long life. Before you pass away, what advice would you give to your family members that are surrounding you?
Be true to yourself. There's a very important quote for me that was from Dag Hammarskjöld, the first UN General Secretary who was assassinated in a peace mission to the Congo in 1961, was also my dad's mentor. And I'm going to paraphrase the quote, but he always said, if the way that you don't choose the way chooses you, and your conscience doesn't allow you to deviate from the way. And I think that for me has been my kind of touchstone throughout all my work. You know, if I don't really believe in something, I'm not going to defend it. So I guess that has to be probably amazing. The most important thing that I would say.
Listen, can I just say something? Thank you for taking so much time. I know it's a long time for you, and you're cold as well out there in Syria. You've been epic. I've really looked forward to this conversation. I just want to say thank you so much. Thank you.
No, you're absolutely welcome. Thanks for having me on.